On America Can We Talk, I talk about election integrity, border security, healthcare freedom, race relations, energy and tax policy, education policy, free speech and assembly, freedom of religion, and all other issues that touch on the God-given right of every American to life, liberty, and the pursuit of their version of happiness. Stay tuned.
Your tolerance, but lecture me. Is there no end to your own hypocrisy? Your God is power, you have no shame. Your only interest is political gain. You hide your eyes and refuse to listen. You play your game.
Coming up next, America Can We Talk with your host, Debbie Georgiatos.
And hello and welcome to America Can We Talk. I'm Debbie Georgiatos. Thank you so very much for tuning in to our Thursday show, my favorite day of the week, Thursdays. Get to do these shows and have a wonderful guest and have a wonderful studio audience. And I thank you for tuning in. Before we jump into just an amazing guest and story today, I want to say a very quick thank you again to Krista Branch, whose I'm America music is my theme music. And I hear people humming it after the show. It's really wonderful. Look up the lyrics, if you would. Krista Branch, I'm America. The basic theme is America and how the future is shaped is based on who speaks up, who gets engaged in shaping this country's future. So you are America. Also, I want to thank Brighteon TV. Brighteon TV carries the show, posts this show. Many shows are there which are not on mainstream media, and they are some of the most serious. They vet the people they put on there. They're serious, substantive thinkers, and they're wonderful shows. Go to Brighteon.tv. You can watch all past episodes here. And finally, I want to mention, if you are listening and you're not seeing this show, you're welcome to come back anytime to watch all of our past shows. They're at AmericaCanWeTalk.org, AmericaCanWeTalk.org. They're also on Twitter at DebbieCanWeTalk and on Rumble and every other social media outlet except YouTube, which we'll not talk about right now. But they're not on YouTube, but they're everywhere else on social media. And I urge you to do that. All I ever do this show, the reason I do this show, is to speak truth about America and bring to light issues that really will shape America's future and preserve our God-given liberties, our promise in the Declaration of Independence, liberties, our right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So today joining us in studio is a gentleman, and actually I learned about him through a guest we've had on the show numerous times previously, Dr. Simone Gold, who is just a fireball of passion, energy, intelligence. She's one who found America's frontline doctors. She's also been very outspoken regarding the January 6th prosecutions. She called me in the car one day driving home and said, oh, you have to get this guy on your show. And she's talking so fast I couldn't even take notes. But in any case, the reason she was calling and the person she was calling is our guest today, Dr. Eitan Haim. He's a medical doctor, and he's here in Texas, and he worked at Texas Children's Hospital. So the short story and our topic for today is he worked at that hospital where the hospital had stated publicly that they were not engaged in the ongoing gender transitioning of minors. And then Texas passed a law, our legislature passed a law saying you really can't do that in Texas, and the procedures continued. And so he became a whistleblower, told about what they were really doing there, which was then, by that point, against the law, certainly unethical. We're going to talk about that for part of the show, and then the second part of the show, just to tease the whole show so you don't tune out early, the second part of the show is to talk about what happened after he became a whistleblower, how our United States government came after him. The story is simply remarkable. So I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Eitan Haim.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. So it is Eitan.
Eitan.
Okay.
Yeah,
maybe I'll call you Dr. Haim. Okay. Eitan. Okay. So let me, I want to do the overall story because it's such a remarkable story, but I want to back up till you're at Texas Children's Hospital. At that point, you were doing your final residency. Is this correct?
Yeah. For a lot of people who aren't familiar with the process, you go to medical school, 4 years, and then at the end of it, you have your MD, your degree. But then after that, you have to go into specialty training. So some people choose internal medicine, which is 3 years of training, or neurosurgery, which is 7 years. For me, I did general surgery, which is 5 years of training. That was at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. One of the best surgical training programs in the country. We're affiliated with multiple hospitals. And one of the ones we work at the most is Texas Children's, you know, the largest children's hospital in the world, really an amazing hospital. And, you know, it's unfortunate because this whole episode is kind of a, you know, black mark for them for an otherwise amazing hospital.
Okay, so you had already done 4 years of undergrad, of medical school, college, medical school, Baylor residency. You've been in school a long time. Okay, and then you went down to do your, this, or part of the residency was going down, working at Texas Children's Hospital. Okay, so you became aware while you were there that there were gender modification procedures, and I assume surgeries or treatments of some kind for minors, and this was at a point the hospital had told the public that they weren't, they told the Attorney General, I think, they weren't doing that anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I really didn't believe it when I first learned about it. And when everything happened with COVID, you know, I had started residency in 2018. So I was able to see that transition from before and after to where you saw ideology and censorship take over the institution of medicine. So people were doing things that were completely anathema to the practice of medicine. And that kind of laid the groundwork for the transgender ideology to flourish and proliferate. Because I had always known about this idea of transitioning young, confused kids who had gender dysphoria. Like, you had that show, I Am Jazz, and that, but that always existed on the periphery of our society. It was always very rare. So I never really thought about it that much. But then in 2021, 2022, you had these accounts like Libs of TikTok who were showing what these people were doing behind closed doors, right? You had stories coming out from hospitals like Vanderbilt and Massachusetts General talking about gender-affirming care for minors where they're getting hysterectomies and mastectomies, which as a surgeon is unimaginable that you can ever bring someone to an operating room and do that to a kid. So this was in mid-2022 where this had started. You know, I began noticing this in our society. You see, you imagine it happening in like Washington or California. You don't think it's gonna happen in Texas. You right. definitely don't think it's gonna happen at the hospital you're working at. So then, you know, one of my co-residents had come up to me and said, well, I just implanted a puberty blocking device in some pre-adolescent kid, you know, who had all these psychological issues and had, you know, multiple family members who were transgender. And it's like, that's crazy. Like, I didn't know that was happening. And once I started looking into it, I didn't see any mention of the transgender program on the hospital's website, which is important because every clinic, every disease that's treated at Texas Children's has a website so that families can meet the doctors, schedule appointments. There was nothing online.
And no mention of transgender surgeries occurring.
Yeah, no mention of it. And then that's when I found the hospital's statement from a few months before March of 2022, where they had stated that they were going to shut down this program because of the legal risks. And it was obvious why they did that. It was to protect themselves because what they were doing was wrong. But I had realized that that was a complete lie. They not only continued this program, but expanded it into a multidisciplinary clinic.
Okay, I want to go back to one little point before we dive more into that, because you made a statement regarding the kind of psychology or mentality that COVID brought that that eased this acceptance of transgender surgeries and treatments. Say that again. What was it about COVID that you saw transition thought a little bit?
Yeah, so there's two things that really changed, I believe, with COVID, ideology and censorship. The medical institutions had adopted this ideology that we had seen becoming more prominent in our society. And what I mean specifically by that is that there is that truth is subjective. It's not based on any objective reality. It's not something you observe in the world around you, but something is true if you say it's true. And this is something that's concerning if you see it in a college classroom. But when it's the driving force behind medical recommendations, that's when things become very dangerous. And that's what we saw with COVID. Because when it's driven by ideology, you can guarantee that it's not going to be effective, but also that it's likely going to be very dangerous. And when you have ideology, right, things that make no rational sense, the only way to prevent people from speaking out against it, from challenging it, is censorship. And there was no place that that censorship was more prominent than academic medical centers. And I can attest to that because I was there, right? You couldn't question anything. If you did, there was a good chance you might get fired. And when you have that groundwork in place, the only way this transgender issue proliferates like it does is if you have that framework, if you have people who can't question, if you have an ideology in place that allows this to happen, and for people to say it's safe and effective, which of course it's not.
Okay, what you're describing, I'm so already impressed with your thinking and observations, but what you're describing within the medical world is also happening broadly in American society, which we won't get off on, but is very much happening across American society. This ideology stated as fact, unrelated to reality, and then the censorship of people so that no one even the things you observe and you're pretty sure you know are true, you don't say them. It's astonishing. I want to move forward. So you're working at the hospital. One fellow intern or a fellow doctor mentioned to you that he had just done an implant of a puberty blocker. Is that what it was? Okay. Mm-hmm. So was that just the one thing you saw or more?
Well, so at first, I didn't believe that the hospital would really lie to the public like that. So I spent the next couple of weeks, months, trying to find evidence that they had restarted it. And during that time, more and more people are telling me, like, they're implanting these devices into these kids.
Fellow doctors.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I knew the people who were doing these surgeries. I was working at the hospital. I knew this was happening. I could see the surgeries on the board. So I know what's happening. But then it was in January of 2023, so like a couple months after, that there was a Zoom conference with multiple members of the transgender clinic. They had a Zoom conference with this huge group of medical students, like over 100, and they were talking about, you know, gender-affirming care in minors. And it was unbelievable because they would just repeat all these lies, you know, like a living son or a dead daughter, you know, saying that these interventions were safe and effective. But there was one thing that stood out. It was a social worker who said that, you know, because of this toxic environment in Texas, that she wouldn't write down consults, she would call them in. And the reason is because she didn't want to leave a paper trail,
yeah,
right? To avoid scrutiny from governing medical bodies. So it's like, as a doctor, that's a very, very big deal. That's, I mean, you can't overstate that enough. So then it's like, yeah, these people are lying. They're concealing. This is why. Because what they're doing, they know is wrong. And then not only that, but 2 weeks before that conference, the directors of a program that supposedly doesn't exist are given the opportunity to speak at the hospital's most prestigious lecture series. And, you know, where they're encouraging pediatricians to ask about gender identity behind the backs of their parents. So, you know, as a surgeon and as an individual, at that point, you know, I realized, like, there's no question. The hospital is lying to the public about a program that is manipulating, mutilating, and sterilizing children. I have a responsibility to do something about it. Not only a moral responsibility as an individual, but a professional responsibility as a surgeon. So that's when I began reaching out to journalists.
Okay, so this is all occurring. You're describing now you're into 2023, mm-hmm. and the hospital is actually holding the doctors who are engaging in this transition surgery or treatments are actually teaching others and coaching doctors about how to handle this. I mean, so numerous people knew within the hospital.
Yeah.
It wasn't like just you.
So it was a hospital priority because the lecture that the directors were speaking at is something called Grand Rounds. This is the biggest lecture series in the hospital. In order to speak there, you have to be a hospital priority, right? Because they try to emphasize, to teach everyone about the most important issues in the field. So for them, they chose this as the most important issue in their field. But this was a program that they had said they shut down. And it's crazy because everyone knew what was happening. So you had hundreds of people who knew, but it was
no
all
one spoke up but you.
No. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think, you know, do you think that people engaged in this, these doctors and the ones lecturing others, Do you think they actually believe gender ideology and so they think they're doing good? Is it money driving it? Is it just kind of, you don't speak up or you don't deviate from the narrative that's been directed from on high? What was driving this?
I think it's hard to say because you can't necessarily gain access into their minds and really know. But of course, you know, I've thought a lot about this and I think it's probably three groups. You have some people who are true believers. They're true believers in a sense. I think deep down they probably know what they're doing is wrong. But they grew up with no meaning in their life. They have no foundation.
No God.
Exactly. Yeah, there's like a God-sized hole in their heart and they have to fill it with something. They have no framework in which to see the world and in order to judge moral actions. So they see something that can provide their life meaning because they never have meaning in their life. And they see this issue of the transgender problem as something that they can fight for. They can be be righteous without the effort of being virtuous. They can be civil rights heroes without standing up to anything that is actually powerful or challenging, right? They just want this fake sense of righteousness that provides them meaning. And especially in this way, because they're creating something new for them. It's like they can be a god. They can take this kid and transform them into something different. When the actual goal of medicine is not to create something different, but to preserve and strengthen what's already
the
been wholeness, created,
yeah.
Right? It's like that's the goal of medicine. Then you have this other group, right? And I think it's probably the hospital CEOs, you know, like the chief legal counsel, right? Because most of these people, they're kind of maybe, you know, middle of the road political people, right? They're probably like maybe on the conservative side, but they get frightened easily. So, when this is happening, they see the dollar signs. And that's one thing that you can't necessarily discount because we were talking about this before. One of these puberty blocking devices, $156,000.
Okay, wait, puberty blocking device.
Right?
And you're talking about what is placed inside a child's body. It costs $156,000?
Yes.
Okay.
And what happens is you have these 11-year-old kids. Once they're started down this road, they become a chronic medical patient for life because they have to be on the hormones. Down the road, they're going to have to get the surgeries. They're going to have to deal with all the complications from the surgeries. You create a tether between this person, this child, in the hospital system for the rest of their lives. So, you know, all these things that provide us meaning in life, right? Like meeting your wife, falling in love, having children is being taken away from these kids when they have no understanding of the consequences. And it's being done by doctors who have no sense of what's right and what's wrong.
It's stunning. You know, one thing I want to touch on just momentarily, but we talked about before the show, but part of what's happened because there's been so much discussion about transgenderism, about it's a new field, it's exploded, all of a sudden every other kid is experiencing this. There was a great book, and I'm just going to, I know it isn't your book, but I want to mention it again for our listeners. We've had Dr. Miriam Grossman, brought her to Texas to do this show, I don't know when it was, a couple of months ago. She wrote a book called Lost in Trans Nation, A Child Psychiatrist's Guide Out of the Madness. Dr. Miriam Grossman looks like this, cannot urge you strongly enough to order this book, or however you get it, and read it, because she really just punctures and eviscerates the whole gender ideology that gender is something you can choose, like you choose hairstyle. I mean, is it that you can just choose it? And it's a really important step, I think, in getting pulling people back to sanity. So back to the kids, I want to ask you about that, about the ethics of this. You know, you made a great point about a child, they'll never have the normal development of you know, growing up, and you go through puberty and that's challenging and all that, but you get into have a normal life, but you also have no way back.
No, there's and that's the most frightening thing, because they don't provide an off-ramp. The way they illustrate the issue in clinics, right, and this is by their own words, and this is what we showed in these Zoom conferences and these lectures, they say that the decision is binary. You either adopt this false identity that's based on hatred of your true self. You have to take these medications for the rest of your life. You have to get these surgeries in order to become this new person. Or the other option is you kill yourself, right? So they say you either become this new person or you're going to kill yourself. When the right thing to do is the third option, which should be the first option and the only one, which is to tell these children that they're perfect the way they are, that going through puberty is hard, and the lessons they learn during that time is what they're going to take into adulthood. And think about this, you know, you have this kid, right? And, you know, they're going through a hard time, they're looking for answers. And they go into this clinic and they're told that if you take these drugs, if you get these surgeries, all your problems are going to be solved. And then they're introduced into this new world where they can find meaning. They have this new family of people who support them. But as they get older, they realize that there are certain things that they'll never get back.
Yeah.
You know, they get older and they realize, well, who am I going to date? Because my anatomy is permanently altered, right? Am I going to have kids, right? Am I able to have kids? You know, what happened to my breast? Like, will I be able to breastfeed my children? And then imagine every single day you wake up and it just gets worse. And one day you wake up and you look in the mirror and, you know, these kids think like, who am I? What happened to me? And there's no going back, right? And they think, you know, the people who were supposed to protect me were the ones who had fed me to the wolves. And then we ask why the rates of suicide are so high. Well, it's like
among transgender kids.
Yeah. It's like, I don't think that's necessarily a mystery.
It's not. And you had, you know, I can't find it easily. I told you when we spoke on the phone, like 2 months ago, whatever it was, I took a lot of notes and you had a phrase, I'm not going to find it easily, but it was an idea about, you know, you out of shame, many of them don't want to say I made a mistake.
Yeah. Well, it's because say, you have this, gentleman, Leah Thomas, right? The swimmer, he transitions and, you know, puts on this, front like he's a woman. And every single day, right, he goes to these women's competitions and he competes and he beats them, takes away their opportunities, goes into their changing rooms and gets naked in front of them and forces all these women to go along with this, that he is a woman, right? And it puts them in very compromising situations. And to think that one day, if he were to go back, he has to confront this realization that he had done this to all these other people. I mean, it's like you dig yourself into a hole, you build up so much shame that if you were to ever self-reflect, what would happen is you would self-immolate because the actions that you've done to other people are so horrific that I don't think that they have a capacity to really self-reflect, because what they would realize is that they had forced others to participate in a lie for their own selfishness. And I think for a lot of people that's too much to bear, and especially for these doctors, because they realize that they were the ones who had done all of this to these kids. And, you know, I don't know if you can ever go back from that. I don't think it's possible.
So back to the hospital, when you went to these conferences or they were giving these Zoom calls, is there ever any discussion of how sure is this child that they want to transition, or how sure are you as the doctor that this is a correct, is there a discussion of what are we doing, or is there any danger to this, or should we take it slowly? I mean, do you hear that?
No. It was accepted as a truth that if a kid says he's transgender, that there's no question, no discussion. There's one video clip of a psychiatrist saying, where he tells a story about a mother and a child, and the mother expresses some concern, like, well, you know, what if my kid decides something different in the future, right? What if I don't want to use their name? And the psychiatrist says, well, you know, I'll tell you, you know, all of our evidence says you either affirm their identity or they're going to kill themselves. So for them, this is what he says. So for them, there is no question. It's taken as fact. There's no assessment for anything else going on in their life. And that's not just hyperbole. That's what are in their quote unquote standards of care. That's what they've been saying for years. But because of ideology and censorship, people have been too afraid to challenge it. But for the first time, I think now there's a pushback that's occurring.
I certainly hope so. And also just, you know, we were talking before the show started about this concept of mass psychosis or just mass human or societal psychosis. And once the narrative is set, it is normal to be transgender. It is normal. This is a very common thing. It's like discovering you're left-handed, discovering you're transgender. And so because it becomes so, it's so pervasive, the person who questions it, you just, I mean, they have nowhere to go. And I in this particular arena, it's so consequential. It's not like you chose a hairstyle or anything else that's changeable. It's so permanent. It just seems like the conscience of doctors and everyone involved in the procedures should be really questioning it all. But it's just, it's not. I mean, it just sounds like it's not. It's just, we're done. We're doing this. This is the normal thing now.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I think the a lot of insight can be provided by a book by Hannah Arendt. She was a writer from the 40s and 50s who had made prominent this idea, the banality of evil. That was in a book she wrote about the trial of Adolf Eichmann. But she had wrote another book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. And parts one and two were kind of dull. They're a little bit too academic. I wouldn't, you know, if people want to read it, yeah, that's fine, but it's kind of dull. Part three, though, is, you know, it's unbelievable the way she writes and the way she, it's like an anatomic dissection of this process that is happening now because it had happened before. This whole idea that when you atomize the individual, when you take them away from these communal relationships, and when you take over society's institutions that were one time trusted, and then you encourage and force these institutions to support a certain ideology, people are left with this uncertainty of what's real and what's not. And because they see everything around them, these people they trusted, these institutions they trusted, saying and doing these things, they feel like, well, I have to go along with it too. Because, you know, all these people are doing it, I must be doing it too.
Okay, we're going to turn to your reaching out to Christopher Rufo in just a moment. But why do you think, totally earnestly, why do you think you were so impacted by this that you went ahead and reached out? And all these other doctors, I keep waiting for all these other doctors to speak up. Why do you think you're the only one?
I think that part of it was my family. So my grandfather on my mom's side, so I'm Jewish, my dad's side is Israeli. His family's from Iraq. And we can trace our family back in Iraq for hundreds, thousands of years.
Wow.
But my mom's side, she's Christian, she's from Germany. My grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was drafted into the German army during World War II, right? So he was never a Nazi, he never joined the party, but of course he was a citizen. So he had to fight in the military. And when he was stationed in Italy, despite all of the risks to him, and he knew what the Nazis were doing was wrong, he had provided fake papers for Jewish families so they could escape to Northern Africa. And when it was the most difficult thing, when the risk was greatest, he did the right thing.
Yep.
He had helped save these families who had survived the war. And just imagine all the people who are alive today because he did what he did.
Yeah.
And then there's other people, the story is very deep and it takes like an hour to tell, but there's other people in my family who did similar things on my mom's side. Then on my dad's side, them too. I mean, they were the first generation of people to move to Israel in the 1950s. You know, they were the founding generation there.
Yeah.
They had moved there till they had lived in tents, right, when they first moved there and were part of this legacy that they left behind. So, you know, growing up with these stories, I knew that if you don't do these things, if you don't stand up when it's a hard thing to do, what happens is for the rest of your life, you have to live with shame. And people think that they can just ignore it, but you can't, and it will tear you up, yeah. and it will destroy you as a person. So.
Wow. Okay. So I love that. I love that. And I do think that courage is finding its way into more and more American lives and because of many things happening in this country. That sense of courage that says, I have to stand up because otherwise the next generation yeah. and the next after that is really going to have a problem. So I'd rather stand up now. And this is an amazing story. It is happening in other contexts too. This thing, I'm going to stand up and speak truth. Okay. So you contacted Christopher Rufo. I wish I knew him. Pretty for a wonderful guy. But in May of 2023 to tell him what Children's Hospital was doing. So explain that first, just talk a little about that interaction with him. He's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it was a crazy story because, so I started reaching out to journalists around January 2023 after the Zoom conference and this Grand Rounds lecture. So I just sent out dozens of emails because I'm like a no one, right? I have no pull, I'm just like some peasant, right? Like some surgical resident.
No one
cares who I am and no one believed this story. Because the story is crazy. So I just sent out dozens of emails and just got denied like a bunch of times. You know, either people didn't believe it, they didn't care, or they thought it was too controversial. But then I finally get a hold of Chris Rufo in May of 2023, after 5 months. Like at the moment where I was about to give up, be like, oh, it's too much. No one cares. But he finally emails me back and we go through this process of verifying the story. Making sure I am who I am and the story is real. And I didn't know this at the time, but it was perfect timing. It was providence. Because a week later, the Texas Senate was voting on a bill called SB 14, which was the law that was going to ban these interventions for children. And I didn't know this at the time. I had no idea. But it seemed very important. So we go through this whole process of verifying the story, and it comes out on May 16th, 2023. And the story, all over the news, in headlines and I'm the anonymous whistleblower who is the source of it. So no one knew who I was. I was just the anonymous person. And the story did exactly what we hoped it would do. A day later, the Texas Senate voted to pass that bill with bipartisan support. And I met the person who wrote the law and people who were in the Texas Senate, and they had printed out a bunch of copies of Rufo's story and delivered it to each person in the Texas Senate, Republican and Democrat. And it was because the story came out the day before that helped a few Democrats vote in favor of it because they didn't know this was happening in their districts. So within 24 hours of our story coming out, the conduct we had exposed was voted to become illegal. And I would argue that the whole time it was illegal, right? The hospital hadn't acknowledged that there were legal risks, right? So it was like additional criminal or legal ramifications were put into place. And then a couple days later, another whistleblower comes out to Rufo. So what took me 5 months to get a hold of him, this person gets a hold of him in
you're still
a day.
The first one.
and this person tells their story about working in the clinics with these doctors and how they were putting these kids on these drugs after 30-minute appointments and how they had all these other problems that were being unaddressed. And then the attorney general initiates an investigation into the hospital. And then the CEO, Mark Wallace, says that he's going to shut down the program in accordance with the law. And at that point, everything goes quiet, right? I'm still anonymous. And it was a month later that things took a turn.
Yeah, I actually want to dive in that story because I had it in my notes, but then reading your story again this morning, I'd forgotten this piece of it. So you were getting ready to graduate. You've finished your surgery residency, it's called, right? You're gonna have real graduation, you have family in town, your wife's here, who, by the way, is an attorney in the U.S. Is she U.S. Northern District?
Yeah, she had been, at that time in June, she had been hired as a assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Texas. She was planning on working in DOJ in Dallas, and she's working there now.
Okay.
Today she's in depositions.
All right. So you and your wife are big day. I mean, after all the hard we're going to celebrate, knock comes at the door on your graduation day. And I mean, I can't even do it justice. You tell the story.
Yeah. So, you know, in one of the most important days of my life, right, because you sacrificed so much during those previous 5 years, you have the responsibility as a surgeon, and that's very meaningful. So the day you graduate is a big day.
Sure.
It's around 11, 12 o'clock early afternoon. Getting ready for the ceremony later that night. Then all of a sudden, get a knock on the door. And I'm like, man, that's weird. I'm like, who is that? So I shuffle over, I'm wearing some stupid t-shirt, and I wish I was wearing something nicer. But I open the door, and standing outside are two federal agents. And they tell me they're with Health and Human Services. They show me their badges, and they're investigating a case regarding medical records.
Excuse me, a case of regarding medical records, or they say
that's what disclosed? They say.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
And that's all they say.
Okay.
So, you know, in that moment, you know, my mind just goes blank, but there was like this deep part of my being that knew exactly what was happening. You know, they were there because we had challenged the dominant political ideology, and they wanted to make an example out of me. Because if I could blow the whistle anonymously, if I can do this and have an effective change, then how many other doctors or nurses would do the same thing? So they were there to make an example, right? So, you know, didn't know what to do. The doorway was very awkward. So I was like, all right, you guys come in, we'll sit down, talk, whatever. So mistake. So we sit down and they ask, can we film an interview? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Can we film an interview?
Yeah, so they start setting up their tripod. My wife comes out. And she sits down, and we kind of look at each other, and, you know, we're like...
She's a lawyer. Okay, she's got head going.
We subcommunicated, and then we go off to our bedroom, you know, excuse ourselves, and we're like, bad idea. We should not talk to these people without an attorney present. So then we go back, and we tell them that. They say, okay. But before leaving, they hand me a letter, and this was a target letter. It said that Eitan Haim... you are a potential target of a criminal investigation. And it was signed by a assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Texas. So the same position as my wife, but in the Southern District of Texas. And a few minutes after that door opens, it closes. And we knew that from that moment on, our lives would change. And I had a decision to make, right? Do we fight it or do we comply? And at that point in time, there was plain enough evidence, you know, so many stories about how the Department of Justice had become weaponized against regular Americans.
Yes.
You know, they target people who challenge the dominant political ideology. They create the perception of a crime. They threaten these severe penalties. They do this in order to intimidate the person to comply with an investigation that everyone knows is bogus. Right? And because the individual believes that the justice system is legitimate, right? They believe that their innocence is their greatest defense, that ultimately they'll be vindicated because they're innocent. But they don't understand that it's when they're dealing with a corrupted DOJ like this is, it's because they're innocent, because they were virtuous, that they're being targeted in the first place. So they know it's corrupt. I know this, I know that it's corrupt, and they know that I know it is.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I thought, you know, in this moment, you know, I think how powerless I am. Like, how, you know, like I have no control, but, you know, there was a realization I made that the only way this thing gets legitimacy is by my own willingness, because this whole thing is a kabuki theater. It's completely fraudulent. They know it is, and I know it is. They need me to play the role of the convicted, you know, of an accused criminal. They need me to you know, play the role like they are just doing their job and pursuing justice. But everyone knows that's not true. So if I just refuse to play along, right, then that's probably the best path. And the most important thing is they need me to stay silent, right? Because if anyone hears about what's happening, if anyone hears the truth of the story,
yeah.
then the corruption will become self-evident. So the decision at that point was pretty clear. We had to fight. And especially because if we don't do it at this point, then we're just passing this fight along to my future children, right?
Right.
It's like this perception like, oh, well, if I just concede to them, if I just plead, you know, plead to some, just to get them off my back, maybe I could just make this all go away, but that's not the case, right? We know that's not the case. These people are not here for justice. They're here for destruction. And I'm not gonna play along and let this happen because at some point, people have to stand up and fight just like my grandfather did.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So, you know, what do you do in that situation? So, you know, we called Rufo, we tell him what happened. And he's like, all right, give me a couple minutes, give me some time. So he made a couple calls and he sends us the phone number.
Lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, this lawyer.
This lady, Marcella Burke. And she's this, you know, like strict Catholic, like rosary in one hand, middle finger in the other, bulldog of an attorney. And she had just quit her position as a partner at this prestigious law firm. And she quit, you know, a seven-figure salary because she didn't want to put pronouns in her bio. So she
God
led this.
God bless her. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So she led this exodus of other conservative attorneys to start her own firm. And that was only a few months before. And, you know, when there was a conversation between Marcella and Rufo, you know, she tells a story and she wasn't sure if she could take this case because it's a risk. And Rufo says, like, well, if not you, then who? Like, who's going to
yeah.
do this?
Yeah.
Like, someone has to. And, you know, she knew that she had to do it. We knew that she was the right person. So we talked to her and she was reassuring and we knew she was going to take this case. But so my wife and I were like, well, what do we do now? Right. So what do you do in that situation? Well, we got two bottles of champagne. We opened them. We went on our patio. You know, we played like Vietnam War music and we celebrated and we planned our war strategy. And then we went to graduation later that night, celebrated with my family and the people who I had trained with. And yeah.
And rock and roll. Okay, I want to ask you, how did the Harlan Human Services know it was you who gave the information to Rufo?
I'm not sure. They probably, you know, it's pretty amazing they had mobilized all those resources in such a short period of time. Because when you think about it, it's May 16th to June 23rd. That's like a little bit over a month. This is a typically, you know, slow-moving, sclerotic organization.
Yes.
And I know this because my wife does cases with HHS, right? She's an assistant U.S. attorney. So, like, if it's a big, like, fraud case, maybe a year, maybe a year and a half, but, like, they were able to do this in 4 weeks. So they had, we knew this likely came from, you know, the central command in D.C. that they, this was a priority for them. So I don't know how they found, but they found out and, yeah.
Okay, and just to be clear, when you called Christopher Rufo, did you give any information to him that was patient identity, patient any way that would have come anywhere close to violating a patient's confidentiality?
Yeah, absolutely not. And that's why for me going public, like I have nothing to hide, right? Like they need me to stay silent in order to make this whole thing legitimate. Like they know no legal statute had been violated. I know that's true. And the good thing is, like, if people want to find out for themselves, all the evidence is on Twitter, right? So I have no qualms. And
it's on your account on Twitter?
Yeah, me and then Christopher Rufo. I mean, the whole story is that the City Journal article, everything's on there.
Okay, actually, I should have had this. Can you just tell our listeners your Twitter handle?
Yeah. So my Twitter handle is just Eitan Haim, but, you know, you spell it Eitan Haim. And then the GiveSendGo is GiveSendGo/Texas_whistleblower.
Okay.
And those two places, I would say.
Mr. Emilio, can you, before we close out and we have his chyron at the bottom, can you add that? It's you heard he said, okay, You hear it? Okay. So, I mean, I want people to see that because, well, give send go. Let me back up and say, so what is the status of the legal charges now? They came to you, they threatened you, and they wanted to record you. Thank goodness your wife spoke up and said, I don't think so. But after that, I mean, what's happened since in the legal case?
Yeah, so that's when the second part of the story really takes off, where I, you know, because at that point I was still anonymous. This was happening behind the scenes. You know, I had not gone public. No one knew who I was. But my attorneys had sent a letter late January 2024 to Congress because their interactions with this attorney were shocking enough to where they felt compelled to really blow the whistle themselves in their interactions, because what they had experienced was nothing that reflected the role of an assistant U.S. attorney or a federal member of the justice system. So, you know, just to give you a few examples, you know, when they first started having conversations, right, in this letter, it outlines the fact that she had never reviewed the evidence beforehand.
The prosecutor. Okay, go ahead.
Didn't know what this was about. So she sent agents to my apartment on the day of my graduation without ever reviewing anything, right?
She just got told, we're going to get this guy somehow. We're going to go after him.
Without ever reviewing anything.
Okay, I do want to say, this, your lawyer, the one with the rosary, et cetera, she's feisty. I like her already. But she sent a letter to Chairman Jordan, Jim Jordan, of Judiciary Committee, and Chip Roy, Chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Limited Government. So she sends a letter basically saying, what in the world? This is the DOJ coming after my guy, my client. And they were both responsive, right? Jim Jordan and Chip Roy. I mean,
We're trying.
Okay, Chip Roy put something out on Twitter.
Yeah, they're busy. We have to do our own legwork to make things happen. And, you know, they're good people.
But I mean, this is the kind of thing. I mean, Congress actually holds the purse strings, and you have the DOJ engage in this kind of conduct. Although at this point, the complaints against the DOJ with respect to their conduct about January 6th people, lots of other people, there's a list of people they've been abusing. But anyway, I'm glad your lawyers did this. So your lawyer sends it to Congress trying to get their attention. But are there formal criminal charges against you yet? Where are we standing here?
At this point, I have no idea. We don't know.
They're just investigating you.
We think so.
Okay. The other thing that occurred, I want to be sure and have you mention before we get to give, send, go, was you had some extremely unfriendly social media comments made on your on your medical practice. I mean, it seemed like targeted, like the enemy would do. And you just describe that briefly.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a really, you know, fascinating part of the story, because during the time that I was still anonymous, after the agents came, about 2 weeks later, I started seeing these reviews on these doctor review websites. And these were vicious, vicious things. You know, like, he mutilated me. He should be in prison. And based on the language, I was suspicious that it was one of these activists, someone who knew about this case. And the reason is because the language was very specific. And, you know, one part of the story I didn't mention was that 2 days before the agents came to my apartment, Rufo had done a story with me. I was just an anonymous doctor at some academic medical center, completely separate from what we did before. The article was called Thrown to the Wolves, and it was just an anonymous doctor's perspectives about the transgender ideology. And when the story came out 2 days before, yeah, I thought it was going to get a little bit of traction, but it got like over like 10 million views. Like, it was retweeted by like Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, and these were like just my thoughts about all this stuff. It was kind of surprising that I got that much traction. But these reviews use the same language from that article in these reviews. So I thought it was a little suspicious. I thought it was possible that these agents had released my name to these activists or someone who then began leaving these reviews online. So what we do, right? We had subpoenaed WebMD, got this IP address, looking into the physical location of it, we're actually kind of close. I'm not going to reveal too much, but if we think this person who is who we think they are, I mean, it's going to be a scandal of unimaginable proportions.
Okay, you know I want to like trap you in the studio till you tell. No, not really. Yeah. but I mean that, to be really clear, to reiterate. So when these comments are first appearing, to your knowledge, there have been no public identification of who you were. So this is people somehow figured out who you were, or someone told them, and they went after you, making vicious, just completely false reviews of you as a doctor.
Because the only people who would know about this story would only be told by like one of two people, either the DOJ or Texas Children's, because they probably were given my name from their investigation, and if they leaked it out to someone else. So,
okay, one last thing before it is time for audience Q&A, but you have a give, send, go, and that's in part because this charge against you, this attack on you, political attack, it's expensive to defend yourself. I mean, you is paying your lawyers, and you have, I believe I read, and you can correct me if it's wrong, but you've cleaned out your savings, everything you've had has been cleaned out to pay the legal fees to respond to what they're doing to you.
Yeah, we're totally broke. But we had saved a bunch of money. We're like pretty
frugal.
Yeah, frugal people. We had saved up a bunch of money by the time I was graduating. We were hoping to spend on the house and kind of set up our lives. So we knew that we had to fight this case, and we knew we had to pursue it. So yeah, a couple hundred thousand dollars, all gone. Our savings, our retirement, our investments, pretty much all of our disposable income, everything gone. But I say that not like for people to feel sorry for me, but it's like an investment, because to have an opportunity to fight against these people who want to destroy our country and want to target people who are innocent and who are doing the right thing, it's a privilege. But the amazing thing too is to see how many people are willing to help us out and to be a part of this fight on our Give, Send, Go. We raised over $200,000, and we're not done yet.
Okay, quick tell, Give, Send, Go. What's it, Give, Send, Go? You just put your name in, or how do you find you?
Yeah, so it's givesendgo.com/Texas_whistleblower.
Texas whistleblower, okay. Yeah. That is amazing. And actually this is one reason I think the DOJ is often successful, I know it is, in driving people to plead guilty or give in, is because most people cannot afford a long legal fight. You just can't afford it. The average citizen, you can go through your savings and then what? I mean, so they end up just giving in, conceding and pleading guilty when they didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, and there's a few organizations that have been instrumental in assisting us. So it's not only Give, Send, Go, but it's, like the ADF. They're amazing. There's certain groups who have stepped up, helped us out, because they understand the impact of this fight, that if we don't win, then no doctor or nurse is going to be willing to stand up, blow the whistle, because they know that they're going to be targeted by the federal Leviathan. So, there's no option. We have to fight this. We have to win.
I love it. Okay, we allow on this show, I mentioned, we have a studio audience allowed to ask questions. There's a microphone over there, and all we ask you to do is speak right into the microphone and try to keep your question kind of short so we can hear the answers and give time for everyone who wants to ask.
Hi, first of all, thank you so much. It's just been amazing. Yeah. Peter Schweizer's new book has come out with Blood Money. There's a chapter devoted to the gender clinics and Boston Children's, I believe, and Stanford. It shows that they're funded by the CCP and people connected. Do you have any insight in that?
I really, for a long time, I kind of discounted the money side of it. I didn't think it was that important. I thought it was primarily ideology that was driving it. But there were a couple things I've heard in the last 3 weeks that have changed that. There was one story I heard from a father in California. He's been fighting this whole thing because his child, he's lost custody because his ex-wife is pursuing this, believes that these interventions have to happen, is kind of gaslighting their kid into doing this. And one of the judges in California has taken custody away from the father, and he can't even see his kid. He hasn't seen him in like 3 years. And like the story is heartbreaking. But he told me a story about a hospital in Northern California. In the operating rooms in any hospital, the orthopedic surgeons always, they get the most OR time, they have the highest priority. The reason is because they make the most money, because of hardware and all that stuff, they get the highest reimbursements. It makes sense, right? They do good work. But there's some hospitals in Northern California where the orthopedic surgeons are starting to get pushed out, where they're starting to lose OR time, where they're not becoming the priority anymore because of these gender procedures. Because the reimbursements are so high, everything, there's so much to be made that even the orthopedic surgeons are starting to get pushed out. Of course, I think there's probably more verification, but I mean, if that's the case, which I would believe, because these implants costing $156,000, I can't even imagine how much these other procedures cost. I can't even fathom how much financial interest is for the people who are part of it. But also when you think about the Pritzkers in Chicago, Illinois, I mean, the biggest funders for this ideology, I mean, unimaginable amounts of money has been going into this because it's every step, from guidance counselors to NGOs to these nonprofit organizations to psychiatrists, psychologists, media, everyone, doctors, politicians.
It's astonishing. Is there another question over here?
I will let you go. I wish we had a magic time machine so we had another hour, because I do want to talk about the China CCP money that makes its way into American society, including on this issue, but we didn't get there today. But it is an issue. It is an issue.
So I have so many questions. I think we might have to have dinner after. First of all, do you have a job?
Yeah. Okay. I was operating earlier today. The two cases, yeah.
With Texas Children's?
No. So that was... I started a new job. I'm a general surgeon in a small town, a really small town outside of Dallas.
Okay.
So, I'm practicing, very busy. It's a small county hospital in a small town.
Okay, so next question. Did you ever go to anyone within Texas Children's? It sounded from the story, and maybe you just skipped over this part. Did you go to anyone within the hospital before you went to the media, or did you just say, no, that's not going to work, I'm going straight to the media?
I knew I couldn't, because I knew that they were complicit. It's kind of like if you worked at a bank and you saw like your boss embezzling money, and they were doing it with like the owner of the bank. So it's like you would want to blow the whistle to the owner of the bank, but if you find out they're involved, it's probably not the best idea. So, and the reason I say that is, if you have a grand rounds lecture, right, and like for them to make that statement in March 2022 requires every level of the hospital to sign off on that, CEO, chief legal counsel, everyone. And for them to continue it afterwards with all the coordination, all the different specialties involved, psychology, psychiatry, endocrinology, everyone else, this requires every level of the hospital to be involved. So. There's no question. Yeah, so if I did, I knew that it would come back on me. They would probably find some way to prevent me from speaking out. I probably would have anyway, but it was not a good idea to go to them, obviously. Yeah, so.
Eric, right here. Yeah.
Dr. Haim, I am so impressed with your courage in this setting. As I'm sure you're very aware, for many, many decades, the hierarchy of medical education has been clear and concrete, with guardrails and expectations at every level, from rotating medical student to senior fellow, all falling in line with the attending. And I think one of your comments earlier was very revealing, and the pandemic changed so many things so quickly in our culture that it allowed really for some structural and damaging changes to occur inside organized medicine. And I'm quite a bit older than you are, but I remember the days when you elevated in your mind your impression and your respect for people that led the CDC and people that led your own academic medical center. And what we saw very quickly evolve was fake science, a claim that science was really being pursued when it was not. And not too long after the pandemic, many people know that the New England Journal retracts an article that condemned a drug that's been used for 75 years in the country with very little side effect that might have been useful in some pandemic patients.
Yeah, it caused like 3 cents.
Three and a half, yeah. And another drug that has been literally used in billions of people around the planet for river blindness and nematode infections and things of that sort. So everything changed. And I was criticized by a close friend of mine when he asked partway through the pandemic, he said, well, now this is weird because you go to the doctor and he diagnoses your COVID. And then he says, I have nothing to treat you with. And I started to say, well, you know, he's right. That's crazy. So a lot of things changed. I think it opened the door for the transgender ideology to blossom. And I think the final thing that I wanted to say was your earlier comment about the three categories of people that have some assessment of transgenderism. The one category that's probably the most worrisome is those folks that do have this God-sized hole in their heart. And they're looking for significance in their life, and they've had none. And so they jump into this because it gives them warm and fuzzy feelings.
Yeah, and I think that's the most dangerous part, because when you have someone's entire existence, everything that gives them meaning in life is tied to this one thing. They have to fall behind it. They have to not stray away from it, because imagine if you do, you know, you take away that movement within them and there's nothing to replace it. Like, these people, it's such a deep hole that they dig themselves into. And I couldn't imagine what it would be like even trying to get yourselves out, because it wouldn't be that you only lose meaning, like this thing that had driven your life, this false ideology, but you also have to come to terms with, you had pursued this false ideology, but you also had harmed people. And not only did you harm people, but you harmed kids, and you did it for your own self-righteousness. So it's like you had the most innocent, the most vulnerable, who had been targeted by the most powerful and the most protected. And I don't think that these people can come to terms with that, the people who really pushed it.
Yeah. We could probably talk another hour, but we're pretty much out of time. I want to, first of all, this was a really profound discussion today. I mean, it was wonderful to have your depth of understanding about the ideology, what was actually occurring, but and also within our legal system and the targeting of people and what it takes to stand up, and the final exchange between our guest, who is a doctor and a retired doctor, and you as well. Honestly, it gives food for thought for so many people. So, Dr. Eitan Haim, thank you for joining me today. Thank you so much. As a very quick summary of our next 2 weeks, we have next Thursday, which is the 21st, Dr. Daniel Patterson, but he's not a medical doctor. He is a PhD. He's at the UTD in the Center for the Holocaust, and he's going to give us a really deep update what's happening in Israel. Go back to October 7th, more information he has about that, and just the growth of anti-Semitism in American society and worldwide. He's just a delightful and really, really wise man. And then the following week, we have Frank Gaffney joining us. He is the founder of Center for Security Policy. And every time he's on the show, I wish we had 3 hours instead of one. I think we're going to focus mostly on Ukraine and also on Iran and the apparent ability they now have to build nuclear weapons, or they're this close. So he's going to be talking about, and the foreign policy that he who occupies the White House has imposed on America and where we are in national security. Because if there's anyone who understands the national security status of America, many people, but certainly Frank Gaffney. So I hope you'll tune in those shows as well. Again, my name is Debbie Georgiadis. The show is America Can We Talk. You can find it online at americacanwetalk.org. I'm going to ask you, if you watch the show on that website, on our website, America Can We, or our Facebook page, I urge you to like those pages. I kind of forgot to say this for about the last 3 years, but someone reminded me recently, please take the moment to like it and share it. That's how the show grows. So, and also you can check out at America Can We Talk, all of our past interviews, blog posts, and I also want to make a pitch again. I'm running for RNC Committeewoman for the state of Texas. Yeah, thank you very much. Okay. So that website is Debbie G, D-E-B-B-I-E-G, the digit for RNC, debbiegforrnc.com. Check it out. Please, I would love to have your endorsement, your comment, your input. There's lots of information there, too, about our endorsements. They got recently some just wonderful, amazing endorsements. That's an election that only delegates to the Texas State Convention can vote on, but you can be part of the process by endorsing if you'd like to. So thank you for tuning in to America Can We Talk. I do this show to speak truth about America because America matters. And I will talk to you next time. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Can you hear us now? America Can We Talk? Truth about America. Can you hear